Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
Although I won Grand Prix at Silverstone, Monaco and Spa, the reason I decided the 2000 French Grand Prix was the greatest race of my career is because I put myself in such a zone that day. If I could have sustained performances like that across my career, I could have been a championship contender. But history shows that I had troughs as well as those high peaks. Giving Michael Schumacher the finger that day adds an extra talking point. Those are the words of former Formula One driver David Coulthard describing his victory in the 2000 French Grand Prix at Manicourt, which he picked as his race of my life to Autosport in 2012. This pick, which was the third of Coulthard's three victories on his way to third in the 2000 Drivers' Championship, is the latest in our Race of My Life miniseries. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today is Charles Bradley, Global Editor-in-Chief at motorsport.com. Charles, welcome to the show. Now, you conducted the interview with Coulthard that went in Autosport magazine in 2012. How was he when he reminisced about this performance? I think it was quite a relaxed conversation, was it not, when you were talking to him?
It certainly was. Thanks for having me on. Yes, we were in Leicester Square, one of the big fancy hotels there. We had a suite and everything, and it was a TW Steel watch launch. He had a new product out. It was very swanky Leicester Square hotel, as I recall, and there were beers in the room, could you believe, on tap. And it was a very relaxed setting, and we had a really good chat about his career. He was just doing DTM towards the end of his actual racing career at that point. And we were able to reminisce about plenty of things, and obviously Race of My Life was on my agenda that day. This is the one he came up with.
Was it a particularly back and forth conversation interview? Did you have to pin him down to one race in particular, or had, you know, did he go straight to the French Grand Prix in 2000 and stick to it?
Well, I totally expected him to do one of those, the Monacos or the British Grand Prix wins, because I just thought that would have meant a lot more to him, you know, coming from being a Brit and living in Monaco for so long. But no, he went straight for the French Grand Prix of 2000. It was that peak time of V10 competition. You had Ferrari versus McLaren, Häkkinen and Coulthard versus Schumacher and Barrichello. And I think that really, when you won a race in that era, it really, really meant something. And I think David, since he stopped racing in Formula One, became a very sort of self-deprecating character. I think he's always been very honest, but I think after he hung up his helmet, he became much more realistic the way he looked back on his career. And I think he's very honest in this piece. You know, he just says that he had troughs. This was clearly a race where he was at his peak, and he had to actually, you know, really pull something quite special out of the bag to win this race. But there were many troughs, and probably too many ordinary days, certainly in that 98-99 couple of seasons where Mika totally flourished and won, you know, almost like he'd win like back-to-back races, wouldn't he, all the time. And David just wasn't able to pin that, you know, explosive performance every time that he truly needed to. But as we're about to talk about, on that day of days, he was absolutely mega in this race.
Even in 2000, you could sort of say that was a similar point there, because he'd got two wins at that point by winning the British Grand Prix at Silverstone and then at Monaco as well. But he'd also had three DNFs, which sort of had given Schumacher quite a healthy lead in the championship. And it was interesting watching this race back. Martin Brundle, when he was then an ITV commentator, says, you know, Schumacher can afford a DNF, or he can afford to perhaps lose this race, whereas Coulthard really couldn't. And ultimately, in the end, Coulthard ends up third in the championship. But he's still charging hard at this point. And I think we should rather naturally start at the start of the race. And Schumacher, pretty forceful off the line, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, he gave him a good old Schumacher swerve, didn't he, off the line. I think David was only a tenth off him in qualifying. Another area that David just always felt he could improve, and he certainly did it whenever he was at Monaco. But when it came to this season, he was always that sort of slightly behind Mika and Michael. So obviously he wanted to make a mega start, and then Schumacher knew that's exactly what he was going to do, chopped across him. And then the next thing you know, Rubens is sweeping around the outside of him into that big long left hander before the right. And I think that was maybe the catalyst for this performance, because I don't think he took too kindly to the way that Michael had behaved off the start line. And then he got his head down and started charging from there.
Absolutely. And he sort of, he follows Barrichello, gets by in the end while Schumacher's at the front, you know, making hay while the sun shines. He's got his rear gunner behind him, but then he doesn't. And Coulthard starts coming back towards him. And it's quite an engaging chase to watch. And then there's the incident, I think it's fair to describe, at the Adelaide hairpin. Maybe you could talk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, even before that, I think the battle with Rubens was interesting because Rubens was clearly trying to back him up and let Michael escape. And I think, you know, David pulled actually a pretty good move on Rubens where he kind of dummied inside, then he went outside and made sure he got a really good exit using the switchback from that, you know, the famous Adelaide hairpin at Magny-Cours. I remember all the corner names were from different tracks around the world. And then, you know, he's got 7 seconds to make up on Michael. You know, just, this was just before the first, I think the first round of pit stops when he passed Rubens. I think the key to what came next is that he took a slightly shorter fuel load because this was the days of refueling, of course. And suddenly he was right back in on Michael's tail. And as you say, we came to this fantastic situation at the Adelaide hairpin where Michael was in full defensive mode. David was in full offensive mode. He really nailed a late braking point and he was going for the big round the outside. And do you think Michael Schumacher's ever going to let anybody do that? Of course he's not. As soon as he got anywhere near the apex, Michael just let the car understeer. You know, the wheel slip was there. He just moved out towards the curb and edged David right. It gave him the choice, go off or... you know, or we collide. And obviously David went for the I'll take the curb route, but as he did it, the hand came out of the cockpit, and as we saw the multiple gestures of displeasure were sort of thrown in Michael's direction.
Absolutely. I mean, watching it back, the camera shot on the TV, the replay that I watched, you can't see any of that. It just happens too quickly because they're just going so fast. And actually the way the car sort of comes back away from the camera, you can't see Coulthard's hands at all. And there's a replay later on and you see what he's done at such high speed, even at a hairpin where they're both accelerating away. And he's just been barged out of the way. There's two separate bits of swearing at Schumacher, which is quite remarkable, really.
It is amazing how much swearing he got into. Probably a couple of gear changes. Yes. It was. I think Martin Brundle in comms, who obviously didn't see it happen at the time. He said, you know, he's got to show Michael some muscle. I think he showed him something else out of the carpet. It was also interesting that David said in the piece that he's not somebody who feels like he is prone to doing a gesture, whether it's, you know, it's on the road or anything like that outside of racing. But he also didn't remember giving Mika Häkkinen the finger when they collided as teammates in Austria until he saw a photo of him doing it. So I think it was one of those classic moments where the driver is so in the zone he actually doesn't know physically what he's doing. You know, it's just an instant reaction. You often hear, you know, you think back to Sebastian Vettel on the radio, some of the stuff he's come out with in the past, and it's just almost like a bipolar almost disorder, isn't it? The completely different persona in the car when they've got the helmet on. It was also very polite of DC and very typical of DC. They actually apologised to Michael after that when he realised what he'd actually done to him. But I think at the time it was quite understandable.
Absolutely. But I mean, he could also afford to be graceful in victory because he does get by and goes on to win. So he does make a successful move this time around.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really, really good race. It's definitely one I'd recommend to go back and watch because, you know, it ends up with the top three being totally nose to tail. You know, Häkkinen catches up. Schumacher seems to have lost a little bit of pace in that sort of middle phase of the race, and Coulthard's obviously all over him, as we've just discussed. And then he gets another fantastic run on him, another slipstream down to the Adelaide hairpin. And this time he dummies outside. He goes early to the left. And Schumacher, you can see him look across and go, OK, well, that's all right. This time I don't have to defend. And it's a classic, you know, Nigel Mansell, Nelson Piquet dummy, because DC just goes for the Daniel Ricciardo full send into the apex. And it's too late for Michael. This time Michael can't do anything. And guess what? This time David's on the inside. Michael's on the outside. What happens next? So the curb or we collide. I think they just glance wheels as David gets a little bit of opposite lock as he goes through the traction event. But it's a fabulous move. It really is. And I think when you look back at that era as well, just talking about David's peaks and his troughs, try and think of another time that Mika actually overtook Michael in a straight fight, apart from, you know, Belgium, the very famous pass that involved Ricardo Zonta. Even then, he needed a little bit of outside help almost. But it's always, when you think back, it's David and Juan Pablo Montoya, the two that I always remember actually sticking it to Michael, really, you know, making moves that stuck on him. And I think, you know, it's a hats off to DC that he really pulled off that move.
Absolutely. And then from the rest of the race, Coulthard runs clear to the finish, but Schumacher doesn't finish the race.
Yeah. And again, Mika doesn't actually pass him. It's Michael's engine. You can see he has a big lock of the rears, which is when Mika gets by. But that's because Michael's engine's already started to fail. And then he pulls off a few corners later with a big cloud of steam, oil, whatever, coming out of the back of the car. I think everything was coming out at that point. It was clearly a race that was a very, very fast-paced race. You know, these guys were really, really pushing it that day. There was definitely I don't think there was any fuel save or any tyre save going on. These were really, you know, sprint events. On that day, Michael's machinery let him down.
Now, as you sort of speak about that era and how bolshy things were then, because they're racing flat out, they're on the limit. You've got Michael Schumacher, who doesn't take any prisoners. He's enraged Coulthard to the point where he's been sworn at twice, but Coulthard gets by and goes on to claim the victory in a fairly forceful manner himself. Do you think that's why it meant so much to him? Because he was able to do a Schumacher to Schumacher in a way?
Yeah, I think so. I think he respected Michael a lot. He knew exactly what sort of a fight he was in. You could also possibly say that David was very much looked down as the number two in that McLaren era at the time. You know, obviously Ron had been through the whole roller coaster of what happened to Mika in Australia a few years before. And I know he'd confided in me a couple of times that it was, you'd see it on the other side of the garage. You know, if he got pole, you know, there was a celebration. Of course there was. But when Mika did it, it felt like more. And it's, I don't know if that's just the green eyes of envy or jealousy, or call it what you will. But you just felt that the team was behind Mika that a little bit more. So I think whenever it was, as much as whenever he beat Mika, that was obviously a good day for him. But, you know, to do Michael and to in the manner that he did it, the way that he overtook him on the track. And that's another thing, you know, the races where Mika did overcome Michael tended to be in the pit stops. It tended to be via strategy, and it tended to be them, the faster pace that Mika was able to set. So I think that's why we didn't see in that refueling era, we didn't really see Mika take that many overtaking chances against Michael as we saw from David.
Absolutely. Well, I think before we move on to the next section of the podcast, we'll just hear a concluding word from Coulthard on his thoughts on that race. The anger had given me such a focus. When I did pass Michael a few laps later, we touched wheels a little bit, off I went and won the race. It felt like anything other than a win that weekend wouldn't have been enough. Before the race started, I knew I was going to win the Grand Prix. Well, Coulthard obviously pretty pleased with his performance there in the French Grand Prix, understandably so, as we've discussed. And again, I think it's interesting to consider why he chose this one. As you said, Charles, he's very reflective and happy to speak about, you know, things that didn't get him to the ultimate prize in Formula One. But are there any particular other wins that stood out to you? You know, he did win many more races in Formula One. So what other ones could he have picked?
Yeah, I think he had quite a few. As I said earlier, I think obviously a couple of Monaco Grand Prix victories are always going to be very special, especially for somebody who's lived there for so long. And he should really have had a hat trick. Remember the software glitch in 2001 that cost him his pole position. He had to start at the back of the field. He ends up stuck behind Enrique Bernalde for 35 laps. And that really did cost him what should have been a hat trick of back-to-back Monaco victories, which would have been quite stellar, you know, from 2000 through 2002. Obviously, British Grand Prix wins would be right at the top of that list. I remember 1999 was, I think that was the first F1 race I actually covered. I spoke to David after the race. I spoke to Mika, who'd lost the wheel. I remember it was the race where Schumacher broke his leg. So there was an absolute ton of stuff. But yeah, David was very graceful that weekend in giving me time to... I sat down with him for probably 10 minutes one-on-one after the race, still sat in his overall stinking of champagne. And, you know, that was really nice. We actually went back a relatively long way, because my first Autosport assignment was in 1989. It was a Dunlop Autosport Star Tomorrow event at Pembrey in South Wales. And it was the year that DC was racing with Kelvin Burt. So he was one of the first racing drivers I'd ever spoken to. And nice. We sort of came across each our careers kind of overlapped slightly, and then obviously he went up to F1 while I was doing other things, but it almost came full circle as I ended up ghostwriting his column in Autosport for 3 years, which was the challenge was never writing it or having enough to talk about with him. The challenge was pinning him down. Where in the world is DC today? Yes. What time zone? Because you'd text him and you'd never get a reply, and the next thing you'd phone him up and he's in Thailand, or he's in America, or he's in, you know, he was never where you expected him to be. But it was always good fun, and he'd always give you a good yarn as well. And then I thought that Portugal in 1995, his first
yes,
F1
his first
win,
F1. Yes.
His only Williams victory. I thought that was a really cracking drive. I remember he'd shown a lot of pace, but he'd made a lot of mistakes, really, really basic stuff that basically, you know, pretty much cost him that drive, which was why he went to McLaren anyway. And I just thought on that day, he was perfect. He had Michael not far behind him most of the race, and he really, really nailed it. So it sort of proved that DC was, you know, well above average for a Grand Prix driver. He was, you know, 13 Grand Prix victory. Plenty of people have, you know, people have won world championships by winning less, really. And he was only 7 behind Mika when they both retired. So he's definitely in terms of drivers who never won a world championship who could have done, you know, he's definitely in my top 10 somewhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think perhaps a couple of other options could have been the 2001 Austrian Grand Prix. He goes from 7th to 1st for McLaren. That race obviously very famous for the Michael Schumacher, Juan Pablo Montoya battle that cost them both. But it really is Coulthard's, he's just so relentless to get ahead of Rubens Barrichello and the other Ferrari and then hold them both off for victory. Obviously, there's the team orders row, not the quite so, I mean, it was controversial by itself, but not as controversial as the following year. Well, I think that's a good example of Coulthard just, it, you know, that showing that pace and taking a victory that might have been unlikely at a time.
Yeah, I think he had a fantastic tenacity to him, and that was really what I remember. He would just never let it go. If there was a sniff of victory, he would absolutely go for it. But I think that the problem with him was some days he just wasn't in that position to be anywhere near it, and it was. And he had no real excuses because of the machinery that was underneath him, you know. And Adrian Newey designed McLaren. And I think he was just maybe a little bit unfortunate that Mika hit his sweet spot in those 2 years where he won the championship. And then obviously 2000 was an incredible battle between McLaren and Ferrari, and it ended up going Michael's way.
Indeed. Now I'm a bit of a sucker on this podcast for a charging drive from a low grid position. So I wanted to throw forward his final F1 win, the 2003 Australian Grand Prix, where he goes from 11th to 1st for McLaren in what is a wet, dry race. There's crashes and penalties galore. Yes, everything seemed to happen. Indeed. I mean, he's fortunate in one respect at the end, and it's Montoya's spin into the barriers that hands him first place. But still, to go from such a lowly start to even be running second in contention is pretty worthy, I'd say.
Absolutely. I think that was the race where Michael lose a bit of his car or something like that, and there was just
against Raikkonen. Yes.
Yes, it was one of those races where the sort of that day the door did open for DC, and as I said, you know, his tenacity was to grab those opportunities when they came along. So I think he was the perfect driver in those days. But yeah, from 11th on the grid, that's no mean feat when you look at some of the people who were in front of him on the grid that day: Schumacher, Barrichello, Montoya, Frentzen, Villeneuve, you know, Ralph Schumacher, Fernando Alonso. You know, he had to overcome everybody there. And then it was a very fitting way to end his Grand Prix winning career.
Absolutely. Now, we always try and end this with I sort of have a decision about whether I agree, whether I can even, you know, not that I'm worthy by any means to overrule the person choosing their race of their life. And I think from my point of view, I think I'm going to agree with Coulthard on this one, because I like the way it's reflective and it's saying, you know, look, you know, we've heard this from him before. Look, I was very good, but I just wasn't good enough to win the world title, especially going up against an absolute great in Michael Schumacher and another one in Mika Häkkinen. So I think I'll let him have that choice because of that, and just because of the attitude indeed. But I kind of want to afford you the same chance, Charles, given the fact that you guys go back so far, and you know, you've obviously got a lot of insight into the man himself. So yeah, would you agree with his pick for Race of My Life?
Yeah, I think I definitely would, just for the gestures out of the cockpit, really. But also, I just think all of those wins in 2000s had a little extra frisson to them because of his, you know, the tragedy of the plane crash that he had in May that year. You know, just to have the fortitude to come back from that. And, you know, I think the first race back was Spain, where he finished second to Mika, you know, not far behind. And then they found out he'd actually cracked three ribs. You know, it must have been an awful experience to go through and to come back, you know, so strong, and to win three races that year, obviously, and the French Grand Prix was the third of them in such style. You know, it's actually, you know, proves the mark of the man, I think, you know, that he was such a really good hard competitor that he could come back from such a bad experience like that.
Absolutely. Well, Charles, thank you very much for joining me on this episode of Race of My Life.
No problem.
And thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Do get in touch with us on our social media channels using the handle @Autosport. And also do check out David Coulthard's Race of My Life, which we'll be publishing. Indeed, I'm sure some of you may well be listening to it published in Autosport on autosport.com. Okay, well, thank you very much.